Ghost Knight Media Studios and Paranormal Underground Magazine, welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
It is Thursday night, and if you can hear our voices, you are exactly where you need to be. She is Karen Frazier. I am Rick Hale. Welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. Karen, how are you?
Well, fine. Happy Valentine's Day. And thank you for people who actually are, like, not going out to dinner or something to listen to us. This is exciting.
This is exciting.
Well, this is exciting, period. We're excited. We're geekly schoolgirls. What do you call us? Anime schoolgirls?
Yes, giggly anime schoolgirls.
Oh, man. I know. So we're going to be talking to Stanton Friedman in a few minutes. And I was pointing out to Cheryl and Rick, our very first guest, back before we were even on Z-Talk Radio, he was our very first guest when we had a little podcast that we called Paranormal Underground Presents. And Cheryl and I were laughing because back then we were so awkward and,
Things have changed. Yeah, and it's funny, too, because we were talking, like, after he does our show, tomorrow he's doing George Norrie's show. So I don't understand how
warm-up act.
Yeah, I can't even understand how we're the warm-up act. You know, we're like, I don't know, Vanilla Ice opening for Ice Cube or whatever, you know. I don't understand how we're doing it, but it should be a good show.
I have to say that I've talked to Stanton a couple of times before, and he's always been incredibly generous with his time and granting interviews because he's so passionate about his subject. He's so passionate about the topic that he will talk to little guys like us, just like he'll talk to big guys like George Norrie. And that's one of the things that makes me really appreciative of him. So it's going to be great. We're really looking forward to it. Going to have fun, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've admired his work my entire life, and it's going to be great to, you know, to get, like, the skinny on, you know, Roswell and what he feels about, you know, Men in Black and alien abductions, and it's exciting to talk to somebody who, you know, is really passionate, really knows what they're talking about. I mean, you know, you get the chance to talk to a guy that testified before Congress. You kind of really don't get that that opportunity, you know, that often.
That's right. And you don't want to be the guy that has to testify before Congress. So there you go.
Yep.
Yeah. So good show. We're looking forward to it. We'll be talking with him in about 10 minutes after our first break. So, and I think we plan to take him as far to the wire as we possibly can tonight. Now, he is really east. He's like in the Atlantic time zone. Is that what you said, Cheryl?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see. We'll see if he, you know, we don't want to, of course, wear him out. So hopefully he can stay and talk to us for the whole show because that's the plan. And I told Rick that tonight, because I've had the pleasure of talking to Stanton a couple of times, I'm riding wingman. Rick is driving this bus tonight.
Thank you very much. You know, it's like I said, I just hope that I don't come off like, you know, Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live. Do you remember that time you were like, get Roswell? That was awesome.
That was awesome. Remember when you like interviewed Betty and Barney Hill? That was awesome. It's going to be the whole show. You guys stick around. It's going to be great. That's why I am your wingman. Just in case you get caught in that loop.
Yeah,
I'm here to give you a little nudge.
I think I'll be okay. I am a total professional.
You are a professional. You know, the other thing is that we've actually interviewed some fairly well-known people on the show.
Yes.
And I was saying that Stanton Friedman, and maybe it's because he was my first, he is the only one that the entire time was like, man, I can't believe I'm talking to this guy. Man, I can't believe. And I'm not even that into UFOs.
Right.
So... Yeah. That tells you of the greatness of the man, and you guys are in for a treat. Because he's so much fun to listen to, too.
Yeah. I've read, you know, I've read quite a few of his books, you know, including the Betty and Barney Hill one.
Yeah.
And personally, for me, I'm absolutely convinced that something did happen to Betty and Barney Hill, and it was not of our world. I absolutely believe that. you know, here was a couple. We're talking. This is the 1960s. Okay, yes. They were an interracial couple.
Yeah. Now,
even though they lived up, you know, near Canada in, you know, Vermont or New Hampshire or whatever, that kind of thing was still frowned upon. So, unless something really, really happened to you, common sense dictates that you do not draw attention to yourself.
That you keep a low profile, right?
Exactly.
Right. I know.
Yeah.
Very exciting. So, I thought before, since we planned to go to The Wire, I thought if we had anything, Cheryl Magazine's out, right?
The February issue, yeah, is out and online at paranormalunderground.net.
That's right. So go check that out. Download it. $1.99. Ben Hansen on the cover.
Yep. Awesome. Lots of good content.
Yeah.
76 cool pages full of paranormal goodness.
Yes, yes. And March 7th, 8th, and 9th. I never can remember if it's the 7th, 8th, and 9th, or 8th, 9th, and 10th. But it's that weekend in March, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I'd like to invite you guys, if you're in the Pacific Northwest, 8th, 9th, and 10th, to come by the Oregon Ghost Conference in Oregon City. It's at Pioneer Center in Oregon City. Really fun ghost conference. Really great. A lot of good speakers. Rob St. Helen from Paranormal Underground is going to be talking. I'm going to be speaking. Elaine Davison, who was on the show a few weeks ago with her Paranormal Safety, is going to be speaking. And I'm going to be there with my new book, Dancing with the Afterlife, signing copies as well. So come on by. It's going to be a lot of fun. And Rick, I know that it's you've exciting. Got something you're doing too.
Yeah, it's in June. It's going to be the Quad Cities Paracon, and it's being put together by Evan Davis, who lives out. Now, if you're not familiar with the Quad Cities is like, it's Davenport, Iowa, and, you know, a little bit across the river here in Illinois. And, yeah, so he's putting this together. It's going to be a pretty big event. He's got some, you know, big people that are coming, and you know, I can't wait to meet a lot of people. You know, like Jenny Gurney and Chris Davis, Rosalind Bone, I believe, is going to be there as well. So it's going to be nice to, you know, to meet these people.
See, there you go. So, with that being said, do we have anything else to talk to? Because we could like go to break a couple minutes early and then be back, and we'd be talking to Stanton just that fast.
Yeah.
Is he expecting us at a particular time, or can we go now so that we can call him?
We can go now.
Okay. We're not trying to get rid of you. We'll be right back, people. This is Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio. We are going to take a break. We will be right back with Stanton T. Friedman. Stick around.
Hi, this is Aaron Frazier, author of Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, a new book from Ghost Night Media. In summer of 2009, I visited Wellington, Washington, a former railroad town in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State, where the worst avalanche disaster in the history of the United States occurred. 96 people lost their lives. What I found there changed my life forever. Before I visited Wellington, I wasn't sure that I believed in ghosts or even in the human soul. Now I know for sure that ghosts are real and that our souls go on after we die. You can read all about my experiences at Wellington in my new book, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, which is on sale at Amazon.com. To learn more, visit avalancheofspirits.com.
Hi everyone, it's Karen Frazier at Paranormal Underground.
And I'm Rick Hale, Paranormal Underground writer.
We're here to invite you to explore the unexplained with Paranormal Underground Radio, live and on the air.
Join us every Thursday night for paranormal talk and great guests from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on ztalkradio.com.
Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at ParanormalUG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today.
Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, Watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
First there came radio, and it was good. Then it got bad. Then there came satellite radio, and it was okay. Then it got too expensive and kind of sucked. Now there is something new, something better, something free. Stitcher Radio for the iPhone and BlackBerry. With Stitcher, you can hear all the shows and podcasts you can imagine, rate them, and build your own station. No downloading, no syncing, no problem. Just pick a station to get started, like American News and Politics. Now, look at the shows you have to pick from, pick one, and start listening. Like it, make a favorite, and start your own station. Don't like it? Thumb it down and say bye-bye to shows like it. Or thumb it up to find more like it. Plus, you can search and find your favorite podcasts. We have over 1,000 shows to pick from. Stitcher Radio, the natural evolution in audio listening. And it's free.
On the go and missing another one of your favorite Z-Talk shows? Now you don't have to. Simply go to the Google Play Store on your Android phone and download the Z-Talk Radio app. The best part is, it's absolutely free. That's Z-Talk Radio, only found in your Google Play Store on your Android phone. Download it today.
Identification. You're listening to Z-Talk Radio Network.
Operating frequency.
On ZTalkRadio.com. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Z-Talk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio at ZTalkRadio.com. We are your hosts, Karen and Rick. Thank you for sticking around, because we have tonight a really big show. Joining us all the way from Canada, we have nuclear physicist, world-renowned ufologist, we have got the man, Stanton T. Friedman. Stanton, welcome back to the underground. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I grew up on radio, and I still like radio.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that still like radio, too.
Yeah, it's all right.
Karen, she's not impressed. So, you know, Stanton, it really is an honor to be able to talk to, you know, somebody such as yourself. Because, yeah, like I was saying off the air, I have followed you pretty much my entire life, your career. And it's a fascinating one at that. You know, for example, you are the very first civilian to go in, document, and investigate Roswell. And personally for me, I do believe that that was an alien spacecraft or alien spacecrafts that came down in Roswell, New Mexico. When you went in to investigate, what was the, I know it was, you know, years afterwards, but what was the general feeling that most people had concerning it? Do people feel that it was something from outer space, or
well,
was it
at that
something?
Time there wasn't a general feeling. Most people had never heard of Roswell, and I stumbled across it. I was in the right place at what some might say was the wrong time. I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, promoting my lecture that night at Louisiana State University. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to do three interviews. I did the first two, and then the third reporter was nowhere to be found. And didn't have cell phones back then. This is 1978. Mm-hmm. And so the station manager's giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He knew the people who brought me to the station from the university. He knew I had other things to do. He didn't want to lose the interview because he had it scheduled, you know, right. This third interview. And out of the blue, totally unrelated to anything, he said, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel.
Right.
Being the brilliant investigator I am, I said, who's he? His answer changed my life. He said, oh, he handled wreckage from one of those flying saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. What? You know, there was nobody else around. He obviously wasn't joking. What the heck is this? I said, well, what do you know about him? Well, he lives over in Houma. That didn't tell me anything because I didn't know where Houma was. I've been there since. We're old ham radio buddies. He's a really good guy. You ought to talk to him. Okay. And then the reporter showed up. Mm-hmm. And I was busy the rest of the day. We had a great crowd that night at Louisiana State University. And I always get livened by good crowds. You know what I mean? I'm sure you guys do. Yeah. And the next morning, I went to the airport early. I had another plane to catch for somewhere. And I thought, what the heck? Things went so well last night. I'm going to see if I can find this Jesse Marcel. So I called information. You know, people used to find people by calling information. You know, telephones, real telephones. And so I called, got a number for a Jesse A. Marcel in Houma, Louisiana, wherever it was. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Jesse. And I mentioned the name Bill Allen of the television guy. Now, I should stress here,
okay,
people have accused me, why did all those people come running to you, Friedman? They don't. I got to find them. But Jesse was one of the people, as I found out subsequently, who couldn't deny his involvement. His picture was in newspapers. His name was all over the place back in 1947. I didn't know it at the time. So when I mentioned Bill Allen and I explained that I'd had a security clearance and stuff, he told me what he remembered. And he was the intelligence officer for the 509th in Roswell.
Right.
What I know about Roswell? Nothing. You know. It was mentioned in Frank Edwards' book. He got the information wrong, Flying Saucer Serious Business. Right. And there was another publication that had one of the pictures that were taken in General Ramey's office. And that was about it. That was a long time earlier, and I'm talking 1978.
Right.
So he told me his story. And he didn't have a precise date. Now, I knew 47 was a big year for UFO sightings, Kenneth Arnold and so forth.
Yeah.
And so I decided to do some investigating, and I shared the story with Bill Moore. And Bill, with whom I had worked in Pittsburgh, there was a UFO research institute that we had in Pittsburgh. Okay. He was now living in Minnesota. he was working with Charles Berlitz, eventually did the Roswell story, the Roswell incident.
Okay.
But he was doing other things, but he checked at the University of Minnesota Library because we got another piece of information. He found an article in the British Flying Saucer Review from an English actor driving across the country.
Okay.
And on the radio while in New Mexico, hearing a story about a crashed saucer in Roswell, New Mexico. And okay. So his son, Huey Green was the actor's name. He's dead now. I did talk to him on the phone. He pinned down the date. It wasn't a trip you made very often back then. You can imagine what the roads were like, but from L.A. to Philadelphia. And while in New Mexico, here's this radio story about a crashed saucer in New Mexico.
Okay.
And so Bill, talking to this actor's son, was able to pin down the date because it wasn't a trip you made very often.
Right.
Early July 1947. So he went to the University of Minnesota Library in St. Paul, started looking at the newspapers. There was the story. Mm-hmm. And verified everything Jesse had said, and gave us the names of a bunch more people. And I did have a third story, which I billed to tell him the next day. I spoke in Bemidji, Minnesota, everybody's favorite town. And a guy comes up to me after my lecture and asks if I'd ever heard of a crash saucer in New Mexico. And I carefully said yes. Mm-hmm. And he told me his story, which, as it turns out, was really from the plains of San Augustine in New Mexico. It wasn't the Roswell story. But he didn't have a precise date either. Anyway, I shared that story the next day with Bill. And when we had the dates from his story, then you could look at newspapers all over the country, you know.
Right.
And in the next year and a half, we managed to locate 62 people in conjunction with Roswell.
Now,
it was the old-fashioned way, with the phone and information. No internet back then.
Right.
That took a little more legwork, didn't it?
Those days were great.
Well, you know what? One of the nice things was that if you called an information operator, she was in the area that you were calling about.
Mm-hmm.
So I could ask, is that a nice part of town? You know, something like that. And I called from the articles that Bill had dug up. We had the name of the rancher, Mac Brazel.
Yeah.
And that's an unusual enough name that I asked information operator in New Mexico. I said, do you have anybody named Brazel? B-R-A-Z-E-L. Mm-hmm. She says, what city? I don't know, ma'am. Southeastern New Mexico. She looked and said, oh, I've got a William Brazel in Carrizozo. I said, okay. Is that in southeastern New Mexico? Shows you how much I didn't know. She said, yes. Well, it turned out Bill had tried the same thing, Bill Moore, 2 weeks earlier, and Brazel didn't have a phone then, but he had one now. So that has put us in touch with him. Now, I also did something. You know, you get lucky. But luck is what happens when you're ready for it.
Sure.
On the investigative trail. Anyway, I looked up an editor and publisher. Is there a newspaper in Roswell? What do I know, you know? And turns out the Roswell Daily Record. So I call. This is in 1978. I'd like to talk to the editor from 1947. Well, he's long gone. What do you need? Well, I've got an article here that says the base public information officer. I didn't know that the base was closed in 66. This is 78. A guy by the name of Walter Hout, his name is spelled four different ways in the articles that I had.
Okay.
And he could have knocked me over with a feather. She says, oh, his wife works here. What?
Oh, my gosh. How incredibly fortuitous.
Well, it happens when you're looking for it, you know, because right. You don't expect the guy who, as it turns out, is from Chicago to be in the same small town in 1978 that he was a GI in 1947.
Okay.
But I talked to the wife, and then I talked to Walter, and he was a great assistant. He had a copy of the base yearbook, and he wasn't, and I want to straighten out something. Some of the noisy negativists, of course, how shall I put this? They changed the data.
Yeah.
he was just a PR guy and the head of the skeptics committee. He put out this story just to get some publicity. I said, you don't even know his name, do you? No. Well, it turns out I've had dinner with Walter a number of times, been in his home, and so forth. And I said, the notion that the public information officer for the head of the only atomic bombing group in the world, you can't get any more elite than that,
right,
would put out a phony story is absolutely absurd. And so, he didn't know his name. I told him I spent hours with Walter, and we'd had dinner together, I'd been at his home, and so forth.
Right.
But that's typical of the noisy negativists. And, you know, it turns out Walter was a bombardier, and he flew more than 20 missions over Japan.
No, Stan, that's
and
what
in
I wanted
addition,
to...
Well, when they ran the tests in 1946, Operation Crossroads,
okay,
more tests of atomic bombs, Walter was chosen to drop the instrument package on during one of the two explosions.
Right.
If you don't put that in the right place, it's a wasted test, and we didn't have many bombs to waste at that time. So to suggest he was just a PR guy is really not giving the straight scoop about the man. And that's standard practice for the nasty, noisy negativist, as I like to call them when I'm being polite. I have other terms otherwise. But what I'm saying is, I got started by accident. Bill and I found 62 people in a year and a half. The first book came out in 1980. That led to the Roswell incident. That led to more people coming forward. And Bill and I, by the mid-1980s, had found 92 people. And I worked on my book and then the Unsolved Mysteries program, NBC.
Mm-hmm.
I got them to do a show about Roswell.
Yep.
And at least 30 people came forward. They did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
to tell the show people that they had heard about the story from Uncle Joe, Cousin Bill, Neighbor John, you know, that sort
yeah.
of thing. And the thing is, as everybody knows by now, what's that program when they're looking for crooks and stuff? America's Most Wanted?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, that proved that if you put a wide enough net out there, you're liable to find somebody. You know, if you get enough people looking in enough places.
Right.
Not 10, but a million, 2 million people listening to the show, more than that, actually. That show was seen by 28 million people. I was really pleased about that.
It's amazing.
And that's why we dug up some people. So what I'm saying is, if you go looking, you find, but you got to look sensibly. It's like, I've been to 20 archives.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them many times, the Truman Library, the Eisenhower Library, the Kennedy Library, the National Archives, and on and on and on. And you really got to be persistent, and you go looking, and most of what you look at doesn't help you. But so what? It's the stuff where you're on target that matters.
Sure.
Now, some people can't stand rejection. Well, I looked, I didn't find anything. I guess it's not worth looking. No, that's the incentive, to look some more, darn it. And it's amazing what you'll find. It's
right.
not that you find smoking guns. You know, nobody dropped
really
the top
that.
Secret file. Well, nobody dropped the top secret file on Roswell on me. Stuff
right.
like that. But if you read my book, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C,
mm-hmm.
about the Majestic 12 documents, you can see how I found bits and pieces hither and yon. Because I hadn't made up my mind, is this legitimate or not? Let's look. Let's see what we find.
Sure.
And I found some surprises. It takes work. And it disgusts me that people will knock my work. Well, for example, one of the things I found, one of the people listed on this supposed top-notch committee, Majestic 12, to deal with crash saucers and saucers in general, is a guy named Dr. Donald Howard Menzel, a Harvard University professor of astronomy. And the kicker here is Menzel was known as the biggest UFO skeptic in the world. He wrote 3 anti-UFO books. One was even translated into Russian. And to be a Harvard professor of astronomy, you don't need a high-level security clearance, obviously. Okay. Now, the other 11 guys on the committee had ones. I could prove that very easily. So I had to get permission from three different people to look at Menzel's papers at Harvard. And lo and behold, I discovered to my total amazement, because I didn't like the guy when he was alive, they were all dead by this time, that he had told President Kennedy, whom he knew because Kennedy was on the board of overseers at Harvard, and his area of interest was astronomy, and so he and Menzel had quite a bit of contact.
Okay.
He told him that he, Menzel, had a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency and its Navy predecessor, more than 30 years as of 1960, of anybody in the country. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. This is the man who's president, who just been elected president. You understand?
Right.
When you find stuff like that, then you really take heart. Let's keep looking, folks.
Right. You know, Stan, I do have a question concerning President Kennedy. Now, from what I understand, President Kennedy did want to have some kind of disclosure, just like apparently our current president does as well as Bill Clinton wanted it. What is actually stopping the president of the United States from coming on television and telling the American people, hey, you know, guess what? We do have people that are being abducted by aliens. We've been visited numerous times. Eisenhower knew about it. He's the one that started, the Majestic 12, from what I understand. What is stopping them?
Well, Truman started it, but Eisenhower.
Truman, I'm sorry.
Fed it.
Right.
Yeah. Because they don't have a need to know, and the intelligence agency people, you know, presidents come and go.
Yeah.
Intelligence agencies last forever. And one of the kickers is that a president is talking to the press all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he can't help it. Press conferences and meetings hither, thither, and yon, and after appearances and all this sort of stuff. And he might inadvertently slip with some information. And besides, he's going to be gone in a few years.
Yeah.
Now, the one exception I would make is probably George Bush the First, because he'd been director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Sure.
Before he became president, see. So he probably did know something. But everybody else has been stymied. And I understand that. Now, people get kind of casual and thinking, but well, why would you cover that up? So what? There's other life out there. No big deal.
Yeah.
Well, let me give you six good reasons for wanting to cover things up. First, you want to figure out how the darn things work. The most obvious thing about flying saucers is they can fly circles around anything we got flying.
Right.
Maneuverability, speed, vertical flight, no noise. Hey, wouldn't every government like to be able to do that? That's when people say, it's German technology. If they had had it, they'd have used it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. You want to figure out how they work. And rule number one for security, I worked under security for 14 years, is you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. They listen to the radio.
Yeah.
They read newspapers.
Sure.
You can't say this is for the American people only. All disloyal people cannot listen to this or read this article. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of really egotistical.
The second problem is the other side of the very same coin. What if somebody else figures out how they work before we do? How do you defend against them? You don't want them to know that you know that they know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, weapon, counter-weapon, counter-counter-weapon. I mean, we've been playing this game for a very long time.
Sure.
The third problem is, what if an announcement were made by highly trusted individuals around the world? My favorite choice, it's going to have to change pretty soon, is the Pope and the Queen. You know, they're about the same age. It's an odd couple, but still. what if they were to make an announcement that indeed some UFOs are alien spacecraft? What would happen? Well, among many things that would happen, there would be an immediate push, I think, on the part of the younger generation for a new view of ourselves, instead of as Americans, Cubans, Greeks, Peruvians, whatever. As Earthlings. I mean, from an alien viewpoint, we are all Earthlings. We don't seem to like that very much. I mean, I live in Canada, and, you know, Quebec wants to have its own country, and all over the world, everybody wants to have power.
Yeah.
But the point is, there's no government that wants its people to think of themselves as earthlings. Think about that for a minute. People in power don't want to lose power. And, you know, I'm an American on half of me. I'm a dual citizen of the United States and Canada. But certainly the notion that we should all get together and think of ourselves as earthlings, think about that for a minute. Do Americans want to give up one person, one vote? We got to give the Chinese 1.3 billion votes versus our 300 million?
Right.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
India's got a billion people plus. You get my point.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
You can't say, well, I'm the big shots on the planet, but well, we're going to have democracy. But, well, that doesn't mean what you think it does. You know, we get four votes for every dollar we got.
Right.
That's the American way, isn't it?
Right.
You know, that's one thing. Another thing that's going on is the Pat Robertson phenomenon. And I'm sure I'll offend some of your listeners, but Pat has gone on record saying that there is no other intelligent life besides that on planet Earth.
Including Pat Robertson.
I would raise the question, is there intelligent life on Earth? I mean, look at our track record. You judge people by their actions.
Sure,
Earthlings killed almost 60 million people during World War II. Crazy as that sounds.
Right.
We destroyed 1,700 cities. This is intelligent people. This year, we friendly Earthlings, will spend $1 trillion on things military. Thousands of children die every single day of preventable disease and starvation.
Yep.
Yeah.
This is a sensible population. I mean, how can anybody defend our record?
No, it's a brutal. It's a brutal population, is what it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, there's two more reasons here. One is some people say, well, Stan, if they're coming here and we're not going there, that means they're way ahead of us technologically, and that means that soon there'll be new methods of energy production and ground transport and air transport.
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of economic chaos. Well, yeah, all right. Not many people making buggy whips anymore, but we've survived that. I think we can manage that. And the last thing is, because I lecture all over the place, all 50 states, 10 provinces, 18 other countries, I hear stories all over the place, and I know that I have heard 7 cases of airplanes going up to chase UFOs and not coming back.
Oh.
Now, if I have heard 7 instances, then there's a lot more out there, believe me. And, you know, Frank Fascino, in his fine book, the West Virginia case, the Flatwoods Monster.
Oh, Flatwoods
case.
Monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Frank tabulates in his book 200 examples of American pilots dying in the air, fatal crashes in a 5-year period, like 51 to 56.
Okay.
And you can get these in the New York Times. And 5 of those 200, believe it or not, were veterans who'd had over 100 missions in Korea. And what's significant there is at that time, the Russians, there were MiGs chasing our American planes. If you survived 100 missions, you're a pretty good pilot, by definition, you know.
Yeah.
They go back to the United States, no MiGs chasing them, and 5 of them crash. And the New York Times used 2 interesting words, disappeared and disintegrated. Strange words.
So blowing them out of the sky with laser beams and stuff like that, correct?
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
But all the cases seem to be self-defense. They didn't go willy-nilly, let's knock us off another Earthling airplane, they're not nice guys, et cetera.
So it's not a Hollywood conceptualization of people fighting aliens because they've come to attack us.
No. No, it's because we've got something we want to protect. People give me a hard time about this one, but see what you guys think. Mm-hmm. I tell people, look, the government couldn't go public right after Roswell. Why not? Well, look at what we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what the motivation of these visitors was. We didn't know whether they were planning on subduing us, killing us, whatever. We didn't know if they were working with somebody here. I mean, the bodies at Roswell were small guys. Maybe these guys are working with the Chinese.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
When I visited China, I went to a bazaar. And what was bizarre was that I was one of the tall people. Because the Chinese are short in general.
Sure.
I know they're big Chinese basketball players, but you know what I'm saying.
Right.
We didn't know what their motivation was. We didn't know how they operated. The Cold War was building up very rapidly in 1947. You know, that's when the Marshall Plan went into effect, because half of Europe was starving,
mm-hmm.
or maybe it was three quarters, whatever. So the times were tricky. We knew the Russians were gearing up. We had to be careful about what they said, what we said. And we certainly weren't going to put whatever we might have learned from back engineering or stuff out on the table. Nobody else was sharing their data.
Yeah.
You don't give your enemies the means for destroying you, or at least not intentionally, you don't.
I would think not.
Yeah, definitely.
So you can see what some people were bothered by that. Well, they didn't have anything to lose by going public, so there's other beings out there. So what? There are strong implications. One of them being religion, for example. Although I was heartened when, about 3 years ago, the Pope said he didn't think there was any reason that God couldn't have made our brethren in outer space as well as making us.
Sure.
And my first thought was, who's he been talking to?
Well, you know, so what, Stan?
You got to think about these things, is what I'm saying.
Right, right. Yeah, I've oftentimes thought that myself about religion. Like, you know, for example, I come from a very, you know, Christian family. I myself am a Buddhist, so I'm a little bit more open to that kind of thing. But I have actually had people in my family suggest that these things are actually demonic entities.
Yep.
Yeah, so it definitely, I've always believed that religion is a huge thing that keeps us from knowing the truth.
This is the work of the devil, says Pat Robertson.
Yeah.
He said there's no intelligent life outside of Earth. This UFO stuff is the work of the devil. How do you find that? I mean,
that's, you know, right. Well, or you call it, or you do like they did in biblical times, and you call the sightings of alien craft miracles, or like they've done it since biblical times. I believe, is it Lourdes, where there was the sighting that was likely an alien craft?
Well, anybody who wants Lourdes to see about good old sightings, biblical time, take a look at the book, The Bible and Flying Saucers, by Dr. Barry Downing. He has a bachelor's in physics and a doctorate in the study of religion. Divine physics is his beat.
Okay.
And that's a remarkable combination. He goes through the Old and New Testament and cites chapter and verse. Now, they didn't talk about saucers. Nobody used saucers back then, you know.
Right.
Mugs and bowls, you know. But, you know, the cloud, the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day, and Isaiah's, you know,
Ezekiel's wheel.
Ezekiel's wheel, yeah. Sure. There's all kinds of stuff in the Bible. But Barry has found a problem. He can't get many other clergymen to talk to him about it. He was head of a church for 35 years in New York State. I mean, we're not talking about just a part-time listener to religious stories.
Right.
Barry's a scholar, and he's a good man. He's a consultant to MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, in religion. And so what I'm saying is religion is an important part of what's going on this planet.
Yeah.
And I've sat for 2 hours on an airplane flight with a Baptist minister who was trying to convince me, there's no life elsewhere, the Bible is the oldest book, you know, he just couldn't believe any of this stuff, demonic again and all that stuff. Now, how do you argue with people like that? They won't look at the evidence.
No, you can't. You can't.
You know, so you try to be polite and you don't give them a hard time, but And you say, you might try reading my book. It might give you a different idea. But
There you go. That's a gentle suggestion. Yeah. Hey, Stanton, yeah. I have a question for you from Elaine in our chat room. And okay. She says, I saw a UFO on December 24th at 1:20, around 1:20 in the morning. I've been told that the U.S. military tests their most secret aircraft on nights where people are likely to be drinking. Have you heard this?
I haven't heard it, but it's a brilliant idea, I think.
It kind of is a good idea, yeah?
You know, I really do think it is. And don't think that Uncle Sam doesn't take that sort of thing into account. Remember, you've got a double purpose. You don't want your own people to know what's going on. You certainly don't want your potential enemies, your Cold War enemies, to know what's going on.
Right.
And so deception is part of the game. And anybody who thinks it isn't just hasn't gone to enough archives or looked at enough stuff. And it has to be. I mean, should we have told the truth about when we were going to test our first A-bomb? I don't think so, because the Japanese might very well have put a whole bunch of American prisoners right at that spot. Go ahead, guys.
Right.
Try it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What I'm saying is you have to think these things through. And I'm a nuclear guy, of course, but I'm convinced that we should have dropped the bomb, because I've read the accounts where it was estimated that if we tried to invade Japan, it cost 1 million lives. And people forget, the Japanese were great fighters.
They were.
Fought to the last man on a whole bunch of islands in the Pacific. Yeah. They weren't about to just give up the ghost. And so I think Truman did the right thing. Not because I like killing people, but war is hell, as somebody said. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get a war to fight, you want to win, to end it. So that somebody else, and it's Japanese, there would have been far more Japanese killed than Americans. And I talked to people, the son of Dr. Vannevar Bush, one of the members of MJ-12, and General Bonniku's son. He was another member. And they knew that people who were talking about being sent to the Pacific in 1945 were not overjoyed at the prospect, because it was going to be miserable and terrible and millions would be killed.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a bigger picture here. And again, to go back to, people keep throwing at me German UFOs. You know, that's all German Nazi technology.
Right.
I keep saying, look, you're telling me that Hitler was such a nice guy that even though he had this incredible military system, he wasn't going to use it? That makes no sense to me at all.
No, it doesn't make sense,
especially after killing 7 million people.
He wasn't a nice guy. Yeah, he wasn't a nice guy. And, you know, one of the things that makes technology developments, and this is where UFOs fit in the picture too, more likely to happen is knowing that what you're trying to do can be done. Hitler didn't know you could build an atomic bomb. He had a group working on it.
Mm-hmm.
But the war was going to be over at some point. If he didn't get it done before that, what was the point? Why waste resources? The Russians, after the war, knew that you could build an atomic bomb because 5 of them had been set off. So if the first one doesn't work, you try a second one. You know, you keep at it. And so there's the realistic world in which we live. The United States was doing wind tunnel tests on round craft at the end of 1947 at Wright Field.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they may have learned something, such as look at the Apollo command modules. Remember those round, blunt bodies?
Yeah.
Well, when I was young, everybody knew that a high-speed aircraft in the atmosphere have a pointy nose, sharp wings, highly streamlined. But the Apollo command module doesn't look like that at all. It's a round, blunt body.
Yeah. Right.
I wonder if somebody didn't say, hey, let's give this a whirl. Hey, look at that. It works. Let's build it. You know, even though you're not copying their technology, but the idea is one that would have taken hold very quickly. Because, you know, everything's fair in love and war. What do they say?
That's right.
You know, Stanton, I do have, you know, a question. You talk about the technology, and how are these entities, whatever are they getting here? I don't even know what to call them. But I know that you are a proponent of ETs, okay, EBEs or whatever. I know that you're a proponent of the idea of magnetohydrodynamic propulsion. Can you explain
that? Well,
that's
within the atmosphere. That's within the atmosphere.
Okay.
I'm first of all a proponent of what I would call a two-stage system. And we have one of our own. You can see the analogy.
Sure.
We have aircraft carriers that carry, and they're huge monsters, about a little over 1,000 feet long. And they carry about 75 airplanes that are 50 feet long. And the airplanes don't work worth a darn on the water, and the carrier certainly doesn't work in the air.
Mm-hmm.
But they have two different functions, and they have two different technologies. And I would point out to you that the aircraft carriers today are nuclear-powered, and they will operate for 20 years without refueling.
Wow.
Think about that for a minute. 20 years. Think of all the gas that isn't being burned in the aircraft carrier. Is the
right.
Point. Okay, so if we translate this to the UFO situation, we have motherships,
mm-hmm.
huge monsters like the Japan airline case that was twice the size of an aircraft carrier, the Yukon thing, 32 witnesses separately, the good engineer Martin Jasek triangulated them, someplace between 0.6 of a mile and 1.2 miles long. That's a mothership.
Right.
Okay, between the stars, you got to go fast, and there's nothing to stop you, basically. So getting close to the speed of light is kind of necessary.
Sure.
But once you get in a planetary atmosphere, at the speed of light, you go around the planet in a seventh of a second. How do you meet somebody for lunch at that speed, you know? you see my point.
Yes.
The atmosphere of a planet is a very, very different environment than the space between the stars. So within the atmosphere, that's where I talk about magneto-aerodynamics, which sounds like a good $10 word, and it is. And I got a surprise. I went out west to start to work on what would have been the best job of my life, trying to figure out how flying saucers work for McDonnell Douglas Astronautics. They had some money that could be spent because it was part of the MOLE program, Manned Orbiting Laboratory. Unfortunately, as I was driving across the country, I heard on the radio that the program had been canceled. I walk in, and she says, "You realize we just let 5,000 people go." Yeah, I know that. They kept me on for 3 months.
So close.
I mean, I had a contract, you know. And one of the things I did do was have a literature search done of government documents with the keyword magneto-aerodynamics. This is not open scientific literature. It's government documents. You got a government contract. You got to write quarterly reports, semi-annual reports, annual reports, monthly reports, technical reports. You got to write reports.
Okay.
Much to my surprise, I got 900 references, abstracts. 90% were classified. There were a lot of people spending a lot of money on magneto-aerodynamics. And you say, what's the big deal? Well, it's similar to the electromagnetic submarine. If you have an electrically conducting fluid, seawater is an electrically conducting fluid,
right,
and you interact with electric and magnetic fields around an object moving through the seawater or the ionized air, you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, and radar profile.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. You know, those are very nice things to be able to do. So there was a lot of interest in that. Now, that's within the atmosphere.
Sure.
But between the stars, I prefer nuclear fusion. Why? Well, because in the first place, everybody in the universe, every advanced civilization is going to be concerned about how its star produces its energy.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that's nuclear fusion, a process that we discovered, so to speak, we theorized in 1938 or so.
Okay.
And we put it to use. Our first H-bomb was a fusion device. Now, we went through a progression. We went from big bombs, 10-ton blockbusters in 1944. They'd make a pretty big hole in the ground.
Yeah.
Remember, we had bombing raids over Europe. There were 500 airplanes in the air at once dropping bombs. That's a pretty loud noise and a lot of bombs.
Right.
Well, 10-ton blockbusters is one thing. Our first atomic bomb, fission bomb, released the energy of about 18,000 tons of TNT. Not 10, 18,000.
Wow.
Now, 7 years later, that was 1945. 7 years later, 1952, we exploded our first nuclear fusion device, an H-bomb. Mm-hmm. It released the energy of a mere 10 million tons of TNT.
Wow.
Wow.
I mean, and that wasn't the biggest one. The Russians later on exploded one that was 57 million tons of TNT. It's mind-boggling. From 10 to 18,000 to 10 million. And the thing is that everybody, when they get to a certain point in their development, is going to figure out how their star works. I mean, it's obviously working, so, you know.
Right.
And the kicker is, I worked on a study of fusion propulsion in 1961. It was perfectly obvious. If you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end of a rocket, they have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. Not 10, not 10,000, 10 million.
That's pretty substantial.
And
so,
and my rule is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. And, you know, a laser isn't just a better light bulb, entirely new physics. And I don't use a slide rule anymore. And I'm careful about saying that because I found out to my surprise when saying that to a class of college students in Michigan, nobody in the class knew what a slide rule was.
I
started work in industry using a slide rule. But you see my point. A slide rule is not just a better calculating or worse calculating machine.
Right.
A calculating machine isn't just a better slide rule. So one of the things that characterizes the last 50 years, let's say, 60 years maybe, is how things have changed, how technology has changed. Moore's law, the number of transistors on a circuit, doubles every, depending on who you listen to, 1 year, 15 months, whatever. That doesn't sound like much, but enough doublings, and boy, you got some awful small electronics.
Yes.
When I started working in industry, yeah, we used computers, sort of. You filled out input data sheets. They were key punched, then taken with these IBM cards, taken with a big reel of computer tape, up to a building at the other end of campus, so to speak, and they'd come back with piles of output data. You didn't go near the computer. You weren't supposed to go near the computer. It took specialists to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I got more computing power on my desk here than we had up at the big building.
I probably have more in my pocket right now, I would imagine.
Yeah, you do. And my point is, that it's not just shrinking the old technology. You got to change things here and there and there and there and there to make it better and put it all together.
Right.
So unless we recognize that, and I'm always debating with the ancient academics and fossilized physicists, you know, those people who think all research gets done at the university, it's hard for me to believe, but it's happened to me twice. I've had two people say, Stan, look, if Roswell happened, they'd have had to pull half the physicists out of the colleges in the country to deal with that. And I said, you've got to be kidding. Are you really not aware of our large, highly classified workforce working on things like nuclear weapons and other stuff? And they're not. Los Alamos was employing 7,000 people. When I worked on nuclear airplanes, which may sound fantastic to some people, but we did have a program. In 1958, we only spent $100 million. 3,500 people full-time, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. It wasn't six professors and 20 grad students. $100 million. It was a lot of money in 1958, incidentally.
Yeah, I mean, these are people.
Can we go back for a minute to nuclear airplanes?
Yeah.
We don't have those, right?
Well, as far as we know, no, we don't have them. We did operate jet engines on nuclear power, and there was a program, two different programs, as a matter of fact. General Electric, big engine jet engine manufacturer, and Pratt Whitney each had a program. I worked at GE. We employed 3,500 people, as I said. And
yeah.
It was a very straightforward system with a few kickers. You take air, you heat it in reactor to make it hot, and you run it through a turbine. Gas goes out the back, jet engines go forward, and you got unlimited range. Can run for thousands of hours, which is kind of neat. You might have to replace the cruise once in a while, but, you know. Now, Pratt Whitney's didn't use air as the coolant of the reactor. They used liquid metal, which is much better per unit weight and volume. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the program, as far as I could see, they didn't have any leadership. The Navy was very successful at using nuclear energy. Admiral Rickover,
yes.
One of my heroes. Now, he said, if you don't want to go there, we're going to use nuclear submarines and nuclear aircraft carriers and so forth. You don't want to go there, get off the train. That's what we're going to do. And so our first nuclear submarine operated the Nautilus. Nice science fiction title. Operated in 1956. Mm-hmm. We today have aircraft carriers, as I said, nuclear powered.
Sure.
Operate 20 years. 20 years without refueling.
That's pretty incredible. Yeah, my husband was on a nuclear submarine in the Navy. So, I mean, and those things are pretty incredible. So,
well, they take periscope leave when they go past Hawaii. They can go around the world underwater.
Yeah.
Think about that for a minute. That's incredible because it used to be that a submarine was a surface ship that could operate underwater for about a day, and then you needed air because
right.
The diesel engines need air. I mean, people do too. You can make that, but not enough to supply the engines, you know. So that the Navy has shown the leadership. And, you know, as an illustration of progress comes from doing things differently, let's take the last 500 years. Ferdinand Magellan, everybody remembers Magellan.
Sure.
His ships went around the world, first guys to go around the world. They did it in 1523. Now, he didn't make it, but the ship did. It took 3 years to circumnavigate the globe. Okay, and then you got Jules Verne, about 1880 or so, saying around the world in 80 days.
Right.
Well, yeah. That's a pretty big jump. That was with a balloon, you understand.
Right.
And today, if you go outside at the right time, you can watch the space station go over.
Yes.
90 minutes. 90 minutes.
Wow.
So in less than 500 years, which is nothing on a cosmic time scale, I think you will recognize, you
sure.
go from 3 years to 80 days to 90 minutes. But not by building faster sailboats, you understand, or faster balloons. By changing the technology. And it took a lot of money to do that. Space didn't come free. Apollo wasn't free. We spent a lot of money. Of course, the money was spent down here, not out there, but still. So what I'm saying is we have a number of examples of how things happen as people get smarter, and they think smarter, and they do better, and technology triumphs. I'm not saying it's all good. I am sorry to see so much money get spent on killing technology, you know, and doing a better job of killing people. Isn't that what we're all about?
It's tribal warfare. That's our main purpose, it seems.
Isn't that a grand use of technology when we could be using it for so many other more important things?
Of course. Look, this year, this planet will spend $1 trillion on things military.
Mm-hmm.
And people wonder why the aliens don't come down and say, let's have tea. I think they're here to quarantine us, for goodness sakes. Who in his right mind out there would want Earthlings there? Look at our track record.
Well, but when you look at, like we have right now, I think in the United States, we have a virtually non-existent space program, for instance. It's sort of been determined to be non-essential. and
there's no leadership. We don't have any goals. I worked on the space program back in the 60s. We all thought there'd be a moon base by before now, and that we would have gone off to Mars. But no leadership. The worst meeting I ever attended in my life, and when I was in industry, you attend a lot of meetings.
Yes.
I was working for Westinghouse on nuclear rockets. I was out at Aerojet General in Sacramento, California, because they were working on nuclear rockets as well. And my counterpart on radiation shielding has said, hey, Stan, you want to go to a meeting? What's it for? Well, the Space Nuclear Propulsion Office, NASA, is having a meeting on what should we do with the nuclear rocket. Oh, that's exciting. Sure, I'd love to go. They didn't know what they wanted to do with the nuclear rocket. Well, we could use it to set up in a colony. We could use it for Earth orbit, lunar orbit. We could use this. We could do that. No, they won't pay for this. They won't pay for that. You don't last long in a program if you don't have a goal, because there are a lot of other people who want the money. Right. And NASA hasn't had a goal since Kennedy. This isn't a political statement. I'm not saying Republicans, Democrats. That's not what we're talking
about. No, I understand.
Yeah.
But he set up a goal. By the end of the decade, we're going to get a man to the moon and back.
And was everybody was behind it. It was exciting.
That's it.
Yeah.
And you got it.
Astronauts were heroes.
And you realize we didn't stop the program when we had a fire that killed three astronauts.
Right.
There were problems. There were things, obstacles to overcome. But a government that really has goals sees to it that it achieves those goals, and it knows that there will be some difficulties along the way. I mean, I'm not talking as a politician, just as a scientist.
Right.
Let me give you a crazy example. Everybody's heard of the U-2 program because the Russians finally shot one down. It illustrates a couple of things. This was an airplane designed by the CIA, came in under budget, too, by Lockheed, incidentally, and it was flying over the Soviet Union. Now, that was a violation of international law, of course. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we didn't talk about it for that reason. The Russians didn't talk about it because they would have to admit they couldn't do anything about it. So we didn't get together and say, we don't want to talk about this, do we? No, we each had our own reasons. Okay. One gets shot down, and we lied, of course. It was just blown off course. And then I'll give Eisenhower credit for standing up and saying, yes, that was ours. It was a surveillance plane. They found the cameras, of course. We had to know what the Russians are planning to do. Well, what is interesting, there were already plans for the Corona spy satellite. Now, it was very successful. The first one went up at the end of 1960 and got more data on Russian military installations than all the U-2 flights that had flown previously. All. Now, you'd think we'd have trumpeted that, and what a great and valiant effort, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't declassified until the late 1990s. So it illustrates a couple of things. You know, secrets can be kept. And interestingly enough, I bet most people don't know how they got the data back. They deorbited a canister of film, which was caught by airplanes sent up to catch it. Okay. Think about that for a minute.
Seriously?
What do you do for a living? Yes, seriously. And you know what? I was looking today at a list of all the Corona flights, and there were a number of failures. That didn't stop them. It goes with the territory. They had a goal. They stuck by it. They worked hard at it. They tried to minimize the number of losses because of money, and there weren't people on board the satellites, but still. And it worked.
Right.
And I mentioned it all partly because there are nasty, noisy negativists who assume that governments can't keep secrets. Everybody knows they can't keep secrets. That's what Seth Shostak said from the SETI Institute, and he gave a couple of examples. FEMA and Katrina, look how they fouled up. I don't see any secret keeping there. He also said, look how badly the post office operates. I don't see any secrets
there. Well, I thought the post office wasn't the government.
Well, it depends on who you believe. But what I'm saying is he knew nothing about keeping secrets.
Right.
Absolutely nothing. Because he didn't mention the NSA, the NSC, the CIA, the DIA, the OSI, the NRO. All of these guys, the black budget guys. Now, Dr. Tyson, head of the Hayden Planetarium, he had a better example of governments can't keep secrets. And he said this publicly. Look how much we know about President Truman, President Clinton's genitalia. That proves that they can't keep secrets.
No, honest to God,
he said that at Penn State University in front of 1,800 people. It's a very clever line. Mm-hmm. What does it tell us about keeping secrets? Absolutely nothing.
Oh, the government can keep secrets. Governments keep secrets all the time.
Yes, I agree. And there are people who don't want to believe that. I had a guy tell me if Roswell had happened, there'd have been an article in the Physical Review, the publication of the American Physical Society, within months.
Yeah.
And I said, you're kidding. No, he wasn't kidding. Well, it was a lot of years. There haven't been any articles in the Physical Review about it. There weren't any articles when the first nuclear chain reaction took place at Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Great event. Physics, boy, what a major effort. We didn't talk about it. You know, sometimes these guys really get me down. Primitive society. So what I'm trying to do is to bring a sense of reality to the discussion. I'll be giving a paper in a couple of weeks in Arizona, the International UFO Congress. It'll last for about a week, and there'll be over 1,000 people there. I'm speaking about a new view of the cosmos to point out how wrong some of our thinking has been. You know, there's only one solar system, right? Kepler would seem to imply there are billions of planets out there.
Yeah.
There's one solar system here.
One here. And, you know, there were professors of astronomy who said man would never fly in airplanes 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight, incidentally.
Yeah.
The British Astronomer Royal in 1956 said that space travel is utter bilge. Nobody'd spend the money for it. What good would it do? What we need is better instruments for astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sputnik went up, and what field has benefited the most from the space program? Astronomy, would you believe? The latest British Astronomer Royal, Lord Martin Rees, R-E-E-S, he's the one who was foolish enough to say a few months ago that only kooks see UFOs. That's what he said.
But UFOs aren't necessarily spacecraft.
Well, I didn't say they were, but I'm saying, and why would anybody come here this long distance just to talk to a bunch of cranks, he says. That's all UFOs do, is, you know, they talk to cranks.
Yeah.
You know, how utterly absurd. And one of the things that gets to me is they never talk about the large-scale scientific studies. I read the SETI literature. It's tough, but I read it. Mm-hmm. But they won't read my books. Seth Shostak and I debated on the Queen Elizabeth II. We each gave 3 lectures, free trip. Not that you can see much in the North Atlantic in December. The QE2 was kind of nice. Anyway, in the course of my lecture, I talked about 5 large-scale scientific studies. And I asked how many people after each one, how many people here read this? Of course, Seth hadn't read any of them. And he did admit on Larry King months later, on Coast to Coast Radio, that he had a copy of my book. I'd sent him one with his permission, Flying Saucers and Science, on his nightstand. He hadn't read it, but he had a copy there.
Probably using it as a coaster at this point.
Well, maybe he was going to absorb it while he slept.
Well, that's a new idea. Yeah, I like that. That's a good you know, sometimes the absurdity of the anti-UFO crowd really gets me down. Do you realize they're assuming that aliens out there not just using radio to send us signals. Why they would send us signals, I don't know. You know, I'm bringing 27 people, be prepared for a good lunch. What are they saying? But they assume that the technology is appropriate to our technology. In other words, is it AM or FM? Is it digital or analog? Is it, you know, if it's digital, if without a key, you'll never interpret it. It's crazy. That nobody's made any progress. We've had long-distance radio communication since 1901. Guglielmo Marconi received a signal in Newfoundland from England, crossed the Atlantic, when incidentally, the scientists said it couldn't be done. It was perfectly obvious they were right, it seemed. I mean, after all, the Earth is round, and radio waves move in straight lines. So a couple hundred miles, and the straight line has gone out past the Earth. Sorry.
Yeah.
But it turns out we didn't find out for 20 years that what made the signals work was the ionosphere. It reflects, it's a conducting layer of fluid up there. And that's what makes the signals work. We didn't even know that, but he had done some tests. He had signals sent and ships various distances away, and he knew that his signal went much farther than that straight line nonsense did. But what I'm trying to say here is that we need to look at things a little more realistically than the astronomers do. Mm-hmm. And people sometimes get a little angry at me for saying that SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, S-E-T-I. But it's an accurate description.
Yeah.
You know, why would aliens send messages here? And they act as if they're sending messages in all directions at once. Now, we used to do that with radio stations and so forth.
Right.
We don't do much of that anymore. We send it up to a satellite. Doesn't take much energy to do that, and have the satellite send it back down so that all the stations underneath it can pick up the signal. It takes far less energy than sending your messages in all directions and hoping somebody picks them up.
Right.
So,
hey,
didn't
SETI send out the Arecibo message that was supposedly answered by a crop circle? Do you know what I'm talking about, Stan?
Yeah, I do. I do, and I think that's
I know you're not a big crop circle guy.
No, but and I'm also not a SETI guy, to say the least.
Yeah, I know.
The kicker is we can't seem to get our minds around the notion that, gee, these guys don't need to listen for signals to see if anybody's around. Every library in the neighborhood lists Earth. Not a bad place to visit if you like the primitives. But what I'm saying is they already know where the civilizations are.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, we've had advanced technology for 100 years. Be generous, say 500 years. Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, the two stars from which I think some aliens come from the Betty and Barney Hill case. Mm. Now, there's a good example. They're just down the street, 39 light years away, 39.3 to be precise. But you will note two important things. One, they each have a next-door neighbor that's only an eighth of a light year away. That's 30 times closer than we are to the next star over. We're out in the boonies. I don't mean Fredericton, New Brunswick, where I live. Nice place, incidentally. But I mean Earth, where we live.
Right.
We don't have a next-door neighbor.
But we're like on the edge we're on the outskirts of nowhere, huh?
Outskirts of nowhere. I like that. That's a good line. But the other thing is, these two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. And you're telling me that they didn't have more incentive to develop interstellar travel when they got a neighbor an eighth of a light year away than we do when we're out in the boonies? Makes no sense. But you never hear the SETI people talking about where, you know, travel might be more determined by where things are. Their kind of thinking leads to the notion that, oh, airlines, they send up airplanes, you go down and get on board the plane, and they take a boat. Where are we going to fly, folks? What direction should we go? You know, that's not how airlines work. They go from point A to point B, and there has to be a reason for doing that. It's not arbitrary. It's not random. So the thinking is just antediluvian makes no sense.
See, now,
and you know, I'm impressed with radio telescopes. I'm not saying we shouldn't use radio telescopes to find out about the universe, but if you want to find out about extraterrestrial intelligence, look at the UFO evidence, and not the radio signals that you're looking for. You realize SETI has put out not one bit of information indicating they have picked up a signal.
What about the wow signal, Stan? I'm sorry for interrupting you, but somebody in our chat room, Chris, actually want to know about the wow signal. What are your thoughts on that?
Probably a government satellite. That's one of many of the signals that they pick up that turn out to be that the guys don't know where they are because they don't publicize where all the classified satellites are.
Okay.
What do you mean classified satellites, I had somebody say? What do you think the NRO is doing up there? What do you think the NSA is doing up there? The spy satellites.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think we advertise all the data that they get or where they are or what sig channels they're listening to, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
That's not the nature of the beast.
You know,
I'm
not a huge conspiracy theorist, but from what you're saying, I have a kind of a conspiracy question for you.
Sure, why not?
Do you think that all of these people, the ones that you call, of course, the triple N's, the noisy, nasty, negativists, do you think that some of them at least exist to spread misinformation so people think those are stupid questions?
Well, you know, let me give you one example. People have asked me, I mentioned Dr. Donald Menzel, guy on MJ-12, who nobody knew was involved in all kinds of classified activities. It's not even mentioned. There are two special issues of Sky and Telescope magazine, one in his honor when he died, another one the 100th anniversary of his birth. And they talk all about him and all the nice things he'd done for astronomy. Not one word about his work as a cryptographer, not one word about his work for the National Security Agency, mm-hmm. and all the other classified work he did. He made more in his retirement from his consulting work, the pensions that went with his consulting work, than he did from his Harvard professorship, believe it or not. So let me give you one example. The question is, who would have succeeded Menzel? Died in the mid-70s. And some people have suggested Carl Sagan, and Carl and I were classmates for 3 years, and he was never in the military. Menzel was a Navy commander and all that sort of thing. But I'll give you my best choice is Frank Drake. And people say, what do you mean, Drake? He says there's only 8,000 planets out there, maybe.
Is this the Drake equation guy?
Yeah, that guy.
Okay.
And calling that an equation is really overstepping the limits
sure.
of reason. Because you can put any numbers you want in it.
Sure.
You know. But let me tell you a little about his history. He got a degree in electrical engineering, went into the United States Navy, and spent 3 years working on electronic countermeasures. That means he had a very high-level security clearance because he had to know what frequencies the Russians were using and what we were using and all that sort of stuff. He came out, he went to Harvard, got the first PhD in radio astronomy, basically, and he stayed in the Navy Reserve for at least 10 years. And his commander in Cambridge, which is right next to Harvard, was Donald Menzel. And the government loves to use professors who can spend 3 months in the summer doing all kinds of interesting things. And so he would be my first suggestion. Because nobody knows about his classified work, and he certainly isn't talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are people, yes, I think you have hit it correctly. There are people whose job it is to disinform. How's that?
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, you know, Stan, I really wanted to also cover abductions tonight. You hear,
yes, we should.
I've actually had the pleasure of talking to a guy who I believe was truly abducted, and so we've determined that they're here and they come here and they visit us. But what? Why are they taking our people? What do they have to gain? What kind of scientific knowledge? I mean, you're dealing with basic. They're Star Trek or Star Wars. We're still living in caves to them. Why do they come here? Why do they do this?
Well, I think they may be getting genetic material. But let me give you some good news. There are two books coming out within the next 4 months, which should shed some lights on things. I mean, of course, I'll tell the book captured by myself and Kathleen Martin, who did most of the work. That's about the Betty and Barney Hill case.
Oh, yes, so yes.
Fascinating well, case, yeah.
Great book.
Kathy has co-written a book with Denny Stoner, The Alien Abduction Files, the most startling cause of human-alien contact ever reported, by Kathleen Martin and Denny Stoner. And I wrote the foreword for it. And it's a good book. And it's carefully done. And Kathy is a social, or was a social worker, and Betty Hill's niece, of course. And she was in charge of abduction research for MUFON for a long time, that sort of thing. That's one book. And I like it. I've read it. I mean, I did write the foreword for it. I don't believe in writing a foreword for a book that I haven't read. Strange.
Sure, go figure.
My book. Yeah. Now, a second book, UFOs, ETs, and Alien Abductions, A Scientist Looks at the Evidence, by Don Dondery, PhD. Okay. He's a retired professor from McGill University in Canada, psychology. And he did a lot of work with industry, too. He's a consultant. So he lives in the real world, too. Now, Don is courageous. He and I were at the University of Chicago about the same time, back in the 50s. But he had guts enough to introduce me when I spoke at McGill. Mm-hmm. Not many professors had that kind of courage. It's true. I know. Sure. I'm out there. 600 colleges I've spoken at, and... you know, the professors, I won't go into that. But anyway, Don's book, which I have read, takes the big scope picture of how did he get to the point where he believes that abductions are really happening. Aliens are grabbing Earthlings. And you say, what for? Sampling? You know, there are many conditions that are very rare in our population. We don't have a uniform population genetically. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There are 1 in 10,000 has hemophilia, for example.
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of other genetic conditions that are rare. So you might be looking for new material. Some people are saying they're making hybrids. It may be thesis projects. Look, when I was in high school a very long time ago, I cut up a frog. Mm-hmm. To find out anything exciting? No. Millions of students cut up frogs.
But the frogs may be going on the radio asking about that. Why are they cutting us up?
Well, yeah, sorry. I can see aliens saying, "Why? What are these people doing? They got to raise frogs for food or what? You know?"
Yeah.
But my point is, we don't know what they're doing. And man is women more so, multidimensional beings. Mm-hmm. We're not all alike, not only because we don't all live the same length of time and don't have the same crazy tendencies. You know, man is a peculiar beast because there is such a variety. You know, if you get a herd of prize cattle, they may all have the same father, you know, artificial insemination and
stuff.
Right, right.
So they're kind of uniform, but people aren't like that. So, you know, I think some of them are graduate students doing their thesis research on the development of a primitive society.
Okay.
Why not? And I say this because I fly a lot. I'm going to be going tomorrow, as a matter of fact, to Boulder, Colorado, to do something you wouldn't expect. George Norrie of Coast to Coast is doing a series of television programs.
Oh, he is?
Oh.
He's taping 5 on Sunday. You heard it here first.
Great.
And then awesome. The 9 o'clock show, there will be a live audience, and George is going to have me as a guest in Boulder, Colorado, on TV.
Cool.
From the big radio program. You know, who would have thought? I travel a lot, and I will be speaking in Phoenix, Arizona The week of the 26th, there's the International UFO Congress, and I'll be giving a talk on New View of the Cosmos, and I'm on a panel, and they tell me I'm being honored with an award, and they're making a TV a video about me. God knows what that's going to be like.
It's going to be about 100 History Channel appearances all spliced together.
Well, that could be it, and they're also going to grab every bad thing somebody has said about me.
I hope
plenty
not.
Of them out there. No, I don't think they will. They're good people down there. But what I'm saying is I travel a lot, and when I'm at O'Hare or someplace like that, people are there for not one reason, not 10 reasons, not 100 reasons, 1,000 reasons.
Sure.
You know, they're not all there for the same purpose. Some of them are sports fans. Some of them are athletes.
Right.
Some of them are killers and thieves. You know, some are there to have a weekend with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. You know, it's varied. And it would appear that the aliens are interested in Earthlings. Now, maybe they want to figure out how can they get rid of the bad genes in man to be such a primitive society with such, primitive society's major activity is tribal warfare. Somebody said that before, and that's true.
Yes.
How come? Maybe if you go to 100 other planets, you'll only find 2 that are like us. You know, I don't know.
And they're probably just as primitive.
Yeah. But remember, we may be the devil's island of this corner of the galaxy. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here, and that's why we're so nasty to each other. This is a penal colony. And people laugh, and I say, you know, that when I was down in Australia, I found they took pride in their convict ancestors.
Right.
They do.
Sure.
And the English dumped their debtor prison people and so forth down there.
Right.
So what I'm saying is there are a lot of questions you have to ask about Earth. How come we all speak different languages? How come there are so many different skin colors?
You know, I was going to say, I can see that for that alone, that they would, you know, want to linguistically study us as well as, you know, hey, why is Rick white and one of his best friends is African-American? I can definitely see that.
This may be that other planets only have one type being. I mean, if you're going to set up a colony, you want nice, friendly people, right?
Sure.
You know, what I'm saying is, I don't know. All we can do is say, what are they doing? We don't necessarily know why they're doing it. But these two books that I mentioned, you'll find quite fascinating.
Okay.
And they're serious and sensible. And they're not wild conspiracies, and they're not wild, you know, crazy stories.
Sure.
Yeah.
They're real people having different experiences.
Sure.
And people ask me about abductions, and I point out that I did meet Barney Hill before he died. I know there are some people probably claim they met him after they died. Not me.
I have. And I haven't met him.
I've been in Betty's house while she was alive several times.
Yeah.
And so I did make a contribution to the book, Captured, by Kathleen and I. And some people say, yes, Dan, but how come your name is first? And I said, when I saw the cover, I protested. I said, look, this is Kathy's book. She did 85% of the work.
Right.
And they gave me a reason. They said, Stan, it's very straightforward. You're better known than she is.
Yeah.
It'll sell more.
You'll sell more books.
Yeah.
What do you tell your publisher when he says if he does this, it's going to sell more? You say, no, I don't want to sell books.
No, put me on the bottom. Make my name small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mentioned that because every once in a while somebody will make a nasty remark and so forth. Mm-hmm. And let's put the data out there. Kathy and I have worked together very well. We've got another book out there that you might find interesting. Science Was Wrong. 14 chapters. We each did 7.
Mm-hmm.
Each dealing with something stupid said by a smart person that stood in the way of progress.
Oh, okay. That sounds like a good book.
Yeah.
Well, it is. And it's a strong cautionary tale. That is, when senior scientists of great renown make a proclamation about what's impossible, they're almost invariably wrong. Well, it's true. And the thing is, there are consequences. That's not just a casual comment. One of the stories in there, a medical story, about Schneewas, who figured out in, like, 1830 that the reason that so many women died of childbed fever at these lying-in hospitals, when the women who deliver babies were delivering the babies, only 3% got childbed fever. When the medical students, they do their autopsies upstairs, then they'd come down and examine the women, not washing their hands in between.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he figured out that it was the lack of cleanliness. The mark of a good doctor was how bloody his apron was. Very strange.
Yeah.
Very weird.
And so he enforced tough rules, and they dropped the percentage down from 20% to 3%. And he was fired. That's not how we do things here, said the head of the hospital. Now, admittedly, they put out a stamp in his honor on the 100th anniversary of his birth. But, I mean, a lot of women died because of that bullheadedness.
Yes.
And he published papers. He did it carefully. This wasn't a wild-eyed kind of thing. And so it's a cautionary tale. We could learn from a lot of these things. The things that have been done in the name of science, with a capital S, that have stood in the way of scientific progress.
Right.
And that's a lesson we need to learn.
I just downloaded it on my Kindle. I'll be reading it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, great. Boy, that's faster. Now, there's a good example. If you had said that 10 years ago, what would
people would look
say?
At me like I was nuts.
Of course. Well, you would have been nuts.
Oh, yeah?
You see what I'm saying? That's
absolutely.
A good example of a quite remarkable thing. You can walk around with a little device that'll fit in your purse, and you can download how many books? I don't know. A lot.
A lot, yeah.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
And the cost is nominal,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. Some of it's free. And holy cow, that's extraordinary. But it's true.
Yep.
It's not mythological.
Let me ask you this.
Progress comes from doing things differently.
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, Stan. I got my Android phone sitting next to me right now, and you know, I was joking with a friend one time about the technology that we enjoy. You know, a lot of it was because of Star Trek. You know, the flip phone and the tablets and everything.
Yeah.
But do you think that there is a possibility that this technology that we enjoy, like my Android phone, which I love by the way, do you think that this could be the result of reverse-engineered alien technology?
Well, I think not, because you can see the steps that led up to things. What was going on in solid... Well, let me put a caveat in there. One of the groups that undoubtedly got pieces of the wreckage from Roswell, the Sandia Corporation. And one of the things you'd ask is, what is this stuff made out of? They had lots of little pieces of wreckage. And you send it to your classified labs and guys with the right backgrounds and all this stuff, and the guy comes back and says, you know, I don't know where you got this. He didn't have a need to know for that. But this is a combination of samarium and cobalt. Why in the hell would anybody put those two together? That's not your problem. Send it off to somebody else. Measure the properties, not the composition, but the mechanical, the electric, the magnetic properties and so forth. And the guy comes back and says, you know, I don't know what this stuff is, but I measured the highest magnetic moment of any material I've ever looked at. And samarium cobalt is what wound up in ghetto blasters, the magnets for the speakers and stuff, you know?
Sure.
And now, I found out, I used to do a weekly science commentary for CBC Radio here in beautiful Frederick in New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to read widely. I did this weekly for six years. It was great fun. Anyway, I'm reading an article about new and better permanent magnet materials.
Okay.
Neodymium iron boron. Sorry, that's their right names. And at the end of the article, it said the original work on samarium cobalt was done at Wright Air Development Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I just burst into laughter. That's at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We know some of the wreckage was sent there. I did some work with them, not about UFOs, and very competent people, technical people, and so forth. So it wouldn't surprise me if that work at Wright Air Development Center didn't lead to people doing some more, checking out these materials and so forth. And as a matter of fact, that wasn't very long before the discovery of the transistor.
Sure.
So there may be a link there.
Undoubtedly.
And,
yeah, to me,
I'll allow room for that.
I absolutely agree with that. We did have a question from one of our listeners, Chris Davis, and Jenny Gurney as well. You know, going back to the abduction phenomenon, there seems to be these people that are abducted, and they can actually prove it when they get metal pieces or whatever removed from their skin. Do you think that there is that's real, or is that, you know, they had it in their skin, underneath their skin, since they were a kid in an accident?
Well, there's no question that people occasionally get hunks of metal in their feet and in other places. Dr. Roger Lear is a podiatrist, foot doctor, and he's one who's been leading the way in removing some of this stuff. He works with other surgeons and so forth.
Sure.
And so the question isn't, are all of these real? The question is, are any of them, you know, from far-out technology, implants is the word, I guess. So, yeah, I think there have been implants. And what would be more normal? I mean, we go down, we capture a polar bear. Can you imagine what he tells his friends? Why are you late for lunch? What these strange critters came down in this strange vehicle, and they pointed something at me. The next thing I know, I'm walking around. Well, what's that hanging from the back of your neck?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's my earring. You know? Yeah.
you realize that thing that's hanging there is sending a signal up to a satellite. If I said that 50 years ago, what would you have said? What are you talking about? You're crazy.
Yeah.
You know? So it wouldn't surprise me if they would leave implants. It would be perfectly normal. We do it.
Sure. So it would be like a tagging and tracking type of system.
Exact. Catch and release.
Okay. There you go.
That makes sense.
So, you know, we are actually like almost at the end of our show. This has gone by so fast, we didn't even take our break. No, that's awesome.
Oh, it's all right.
Talking to you. Do you have any books or anything coming out right now, or are you writing anymore?
Well, I'm thinking about it. I've got 5 books out there. Crash at Corona, the definitive story of the Roswell incident, and Top Secret Magic, all about MJ-12, and Flying Saucers in Physics, Flying Saucers in Science, sorry.
Yeah.
And Captured, and Science Was Wrong.
Right.
Now, I do have 2 chapters in a book about aliens and UFOs. I'm the only one with 2 in there. Kathleen Martin has 1 in there, too, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm writing this paper, I just finished it today, for the conference in Phoenix.
Right.
I'll be speaking in Roswell again, as usual, in early July this year. I've got a bunch of other engagements. What?
No, I bet it's not warm in Roswell in July.
Well, it doesn't get much hotter than 108.
Oh, God. I live in Western Washington, so to me that sounds horrifying.
No, but you know what? I live in Chicago, just, you know, 40 miles north of the city. And during the summer, we have got the most horrible. It's so sticky and wet and gross here. So I would rather prefer, you know,
108 summers Roswell.
Down there. Yeah, well, it's a desert.
Roswell is dry now.
Yeah.
It's desert climate. And now, if you go to Roswell, and I do recommend it, the museum is worth going to and stuff.
Sure.
Be wary of the sun. You can get a sunburn in flat.
I bet.
You're at 3,500 feet, you see. And no moisture in the air to absorb the ultraviolet. So,
if I go down, I'll wear a beekeeper suit so that, you know, to reflect it off, I'll be fine. So
I'm Irish. I burst into flames in the sun.
What else do you have coming up, Stan?
Well, I'm going to be in Texas, in Edinburgh, Texas. I'll be in Kansas City. I'll try to list them. I'm a little behind, but I want to list them on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com.
Okay.
And have slides, or no, have PowerPoint will travel. Can't use the word slides anymore.
No, it's PowerPoint. And how about this television program that you're filming? Do you know when that's going to air? And
well, I wish I did. I don't yet know, but it should be fun. I've done a lot of shows with George Norrie.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, he usually brags that I was his first interview back in the 70s when he was a young journalist. And the boss asked him to go interview this guy talking about flying saucers. And that was his
first
interview.
You get us all started.
Yeah. Why not?
Sure.
That's my contribution to mankind.
That's right. So the website is stantonfriedman.com, and you have and people can sort of have an idea of what's coming up for you on there then, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And my books are all listed there, and you can use PayPal and stuff like that. And there are several articles, no charge for the articles. The UFO why questions is on there, and some strong comments about the Bob Lazar fraud and stuff like that.
Great.
That just made 27 people angry, but
that's all right. That's to the people listening, this is what you need to do, because I know a lot of you had questions that we just didn't get to, and I apologize for that. But I bet you can find a lot of the answers if you go on to stantonfriedman.com, right? .com.
Yes.
Yeah, stantonfriedman.com. And if you go to his website, you can read his papers, you can order his books, and, you're always on, you always got something on the History Channel, too, Stan.
Yeah, there's a lot of those things out there. Somebody today said, hey, you're on TV. It was a Larry King show that I had done, I don't know how many years ago.
Great. Well, thank you so much. You have been a huge part of Paranormal Underground Radio history because you were our first guest, and now you're back again, and I hope that we don't wait another 3 years to have you back, because I always really love talking to you, and I know people really love listening what you have to say. So thank you so much.
I enjoy the program.
Thank you very much.
Have fun, even if you're in Chicago and Washington.
Yeah, and have a safe trip to Colorado.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Good night.
Thank you, Stan.
All right. There you guys go. Stanton Friedman, everyone. It's stantonfriedman.com. His website is great, and his stuff is fun to read. And whenever he's on TV, catch him, because he's awful. He's an awful lot of fun to watch speak as well.
You said, when you first were like, oh, he's awful.
No, he's awful fun.
Yeah.
No. Are you kidding me? I think he's great. So you guys asked all sorts of questions, and we hardly asked any of them.
Yeah, I still have let me see. I got through, one.
Questions.
I got through one.
Pitchforks and torches, you can come after us, because we didn't ask your questions. We're very sorry.
Yep.
Next time, we'll do it. We'll do it sooner, right, Cheryl?
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, now you know how to get all... I don't know why. I mean, we loved him the last time we had him on. Maybe we were embarrassed because we were so bad the first time. He said, because when we had him off the air, and, Cheryl said, this is Cheryl from Paranormal Underground Radio, and he said, I remember you guys. And I thought, oh, God, we really were that bad.
I think it might have been 4 years ago, actually. Didn't we talk to him in 2009 at the beginning of the year?
2009.
Yeah, so it's been a long while, but hopefully it's not going to be that long next time.
No. And, I've read several of his books. His books are really engaging and a lot of fun to read.
Yeah, I read Captured, and I really, really enjoyed that. And that really, that book alone actually convinced me that there was something to the alien abduction. Mm-hmm. And then years and years later, I, was able to, had the opportunity to speak to a gentleman. I can't give his name because I promised, and I'm going to keep that promise.
Rick Hale. No.
No, I've never been abducted, but, it was those two things that convinced me that we are being visited, something is taking us, and, or in Antonio Villas-Boas's, he gets a high five for what happened to him down in Brazil back in the 50s. having, you know, basically sexual congress with somebody from a UFO. But yeah, it really does seem that they do come here to, you know, take genetic material from us.
Yeah, yeah. By, you know, I guess what I got from what he was saying also is that, you know, when you're at an airport, there are people at airports for lots of different reasons. And sure. So when we say, why are you here? Why are they here? Well, probably lots of reasons.
Sure. Well, and any number. Yeah. And it's like, you know, we can barely understand the psychology of our fellow man. How are we going to understand the intentions and psychology of somebody who is vastly more intelligent and more technologically advanced than we could ever dream to be?
That's right. So, hey, we just have a few minutes left. We need to wrap up. So go to paranormalunderground.net, download the new issue of the magazine. Is Fox Cities doing a show after us tonight, Cheryl? Do you know?
I think they are.
All right, so stick around for Fox Cities Paranormal after the show. What else am I supposed to remember
next week? We are going to be talking to Duncan Lunan. He wrote the book Children from the Sky. That is about the green children of Woolpit. And that's a story that goes way back from Suffolk, England.
All right. So next week, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, other times in the flyover states. It is Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and have a good night.
Talk to you later.
Oh, and happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, yep, happy Valentine's Day.
Yay.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Underground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next week, keep exploring the unexplained at www.paranormalunderground.net and join us again next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the Z-Talk Radio Network.